You have tuned in to Open Mic on CJSF Radio, broadcasting from 90.1 FM from Burnaby Mountain, BC.
Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here with you again. Welcome to my Open Mic. This is an episode of Open Mic broadcasting in Burnaby Mountain and ceded territories of the Coast Salish people, including the Musqueam, Squamish, Coquitlam, Katsi Nations, and Tsleil-Waututh. Unceded means that these territories have never been given up nor sold, and we are currently situated in occupied territories. So thank you so much for everyone that is here again with me. Today we have a really special episode with me. It's an introduction to a cover that I'll be doing in the following weeks of the Conference of the Parts, an environmental convention that is happening with several leaders from across the world. And this is a first step, which is talking a little bit about indigenous active and environmental activism here in British Columbia. But first, before it all, I would like to play a song from Léo Mendes. Léo Mendes is a dear friend of mine. He's from Brazil. He started composing his own songs now. It's a song in Portuguese. I can explain a little bit of it just after the song. And he has a really interesting background of a lot of going through a lot, and I think it's really important for me to see him doing well and even releasing songs, so that's why I'm playing. So I hope you all enjoy a little bit of the songs Devaneios from Léo Mendes.
Se quiser, pode me levar.
Me traga um copo meio cheio. Trago um copo meio cheio, meus devaneios quero todos derrubar. Me dê um gole do seu beijo, doce desejo, perdição no seu olhar. E as manhãs ainda até sem frio, eu conto as horas pra te ver chegar. Sei que lá fora o tempo é chuva, a garoa continua e eu sigo a caminhar. Me diz por quê tanta demora? É mentira desse mundo dizer que homem não chora. Estou chorando agora, vendo seus retratos espalhados pela casa fora. Me traga um copo menos cheio, em uma dose agora eu quero me afogar. Pensando bem, não sou certeiro, mas o maior dos meus acertos é ter você pra caminhar. Me diz por quê demora? É mentira desse mundo dizer que homem não chora. Estou chorando agora, vendo seus retratos espalhados pela casa fora. esqueço o copo meio cheio. Quero por inteiro, minha sina é te amar. Esqueça dos meus devaneios, me abrace, abra o peito e me deixe te ajudar. Me diz por que tanta demora. É mentira desse mundo dizer que homem não chora. Estou chorando agora, vendo seus retratos e pensando quando você voltar.
Oi, meu amor.
And we're back. Thank you for so much for everyone who stay tuned in. I hope you enjoyed. This is a really romantic song. He's basically talking about how he misses his love, and how he wants her to come back faster. A really poetic way of describing how it's raining outside and things seems to pass slowly, and then he just wanna grab a cup of beer while he waits for her to come back. Really poetic. If you ever want to find it, will be on CJSF website, where you can find the playlist and this episode for you to listen it for it again if you want. And following, I'll have now the interview pre-recorded with Ting Lian. And yeah, thank you so much for staying tuned in. I hope you enjoy. Here you go. You're listening to CJSF Radio 9.1 FM, broadcasting from the traditional and city territories of the Coast Salish people, including the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam and Katsi nations. Unceded means that these lands have never been surrendered, sold, or given up by these nations, and were currently situated in occupied territories. With that in mind, welcome everyone. My name is Iago, and today I'm presenting here our honored guest named Jin Layden. He's an indigenous elder, land defender, a powerful voice for climate justice advocacy right here in British Columbia. He's been the forefront at the fight against the TMX pipeline for a long time, and his work has demonstrated a great demonstration of strength, resilience, and a fight that is important for all of us when it comes to a sustainable future. So, Jim, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us. Would you like to introduce yourself a little bit better, your background, your culture, where you come from?
Sure. My name is Stemmikoch Kanem. It's a spirit name that's been given at Sundance and stuff, right? And it means Stem is little, Mekoch is black bear, Kanem is warrior. Right, so it's little black bear warrior. And it came about because at one point we were first setting up one of the sun dances. There was a baby, like less than a year old, bear running down the hill. So I ran out to kind of make sure. I wasn't sure if it was hunters that were after or whatever, right? So got out there so I could be seen. And I don't even know, I never did see what it was running from, but they ended up, that's like... So the little is aimed at the bear. So I was told later we could eliminate the Mekoch and just be, or eliminate Stem and just be Mekoch Kanem. Because the bear is not little anymore. I was adopted into a Scottish family named the Laydens, hence my name, James McNeil Layden. I was put into care. They talk about the 60s scoop. My mother was Anishinaabe, my father was Irish. I was put into care basically at around 1 year of age to start with, and taken out a couple of times, put back in. And I stayed in the children's aid in Ontario, in care in the children's aid till I was seven. I was adopted into a family, moved away from my hometown, which was Brantford. And I moved away from my hometown and into Oakville, Ontario. And that was one of their policies at that point, was to separate the families, other than putting them into foster cares. So it was an adoption. It usually didn't happen in the hometown. So they moved me to Oakville. And So that's significant because a part of my, I also ended up, as is the history of a lot of people who have been through care, I ended up as a drug addict and alcoholic and got clean for that. I'm now like 39 years clean and sober. Why I became an activist, I guess, because what happened in youth was an absolute disempowerment. So it seemed really natural for me to go into situations where I was empowering people, where I was standing up for those that had been abused or standing up for society, as happens with the pipeline. And the first time I got arrested, I basically told them I wanted to get arrested. I said, I want to get this in front of the courts, and you guys can take it from there and determine that we are on unceded territory, we're in sovereign land, and we have the right to tell you what we can do and what you can do on this land. You don't have the right to put a pipeline through our land without our permission. And so that's part of that. I was involved before that in fights around homelessness in Vancouver, and I started off as a young teenager, like 13 years old, in high school, fighting over the California grapes boycott and being part of an underground, underground media, underground press, that was really reporting a whole bunch on the Vietnam War and stuff at the time. So I kind of raised right from there. There's always been a thread of activism throughout my life, and I think that ties back into the fact that I was so disempowered by being put in the children's aid and adopted out of my community and everything else. I always remember the last foster home I was at, standing there with a little suitcase in one hand and a small apple tree in the other that I had started from scratch, and wondering why the hell I was having, why I was being taken away from this family. We seemed to get along well, but that was always their policy. There was, you never stayed in a family for very long, so I moved around for several families, and ended up getting my training as in social work and counseling and stuff, and took that on as my corporate career, I guess, as my but I always have connected with the land, and I remember kayaking up. We were the first kayak, myself and another fella. We were the first kayaks on the Indian Arm. Deep Cove. Used to be Deep Cove canoes, and that's all they sold was canoes, or rented was canoes. But we took the kayaks, and we went up the Indian Arm River, and you could see the salmon. You hear people talking about that, and I can testify that it's real. You can see all this red on the bottom of the river.
And when was that?
The Indian Arm River, just at the end of Burrard Inlet.
When you were how old?
Oh, I was in my 20s and late 20s and stuff, yeah.
In your 20s. Yeah, I can. Oh, I love the how much you brought up already. I was gonna try to go around uncovering some of your connections to your family, and I think it's outrageous. I've used that word before, but it's just how the policies around child care and the foster care used to work. Before getting to the system, do you remember just anything positive on, like, you've enjoyed as a traditional childhood, like I don't know, any type of games or anything that ties back to your community?
I don't know, games. I do remember kind of I had two brothers and a sister, all younger than me. I was the oldest in the family, and I always remember sitting on lawn chairs, you know, those aluminum lawn chairs. I remember sitting there, and we were on a out by a tobacco farm in Brantford, and I just remember it's just a vision I have. I remember sitting there, you know, and I remember talking to my dad a few times and stuff, and then while I was in foster care, I remember him taking me out for a day, he was still an alcoholic. But he took me out, took me on a bicycle and drove me from my foster home, which is out in the country, into town in Brantford. And I remember us going to this big park, and there was a fountain with lions' heads that were spitting water, and he get me up there to drink some of that water and stuff. So that's the good part. I'm going to say that I don't remember being taken away and being in foster care a few times, but I remember the one time, and my dad got into a taxi, and he said he had to go, and it sounded like he was going to treatment. So I had to go to a hospital and get some of his problems taken care of, and so I'm sitting there and I'm watching. I had a sense there was more to it than that. I probably had the urgency from having been separated before. And I remember looking out the window and just, I don't know, they bought me some kind of a toy to play with the neighbors. So I was staying at the neighbor's while I could see the taxi going up the hill. We were down in the little valley by a tobacco farm. And I could see the taxi going up the hill, and I just started screaming. And they couldn't control me, and I just knew there was more to it than just him taking a taxi out for a while. And the next thing, a police officer and a social worker came and got me. And they took me into the cop car. And I'm sure by that time I was probably absolutely ballistic, you know. Because none of this made sense to me. And they took me to the holding, because they were doing all the scoops at that point. They took me to this house where they had stuff in the backyard that kids could play on. And so they get me back there, and the woman says, "Well, you go in the backyard and play, and I'll take care of some stuff, and I'll come get you. We'll get you something to eat and stuff." Oh, okay. And I go out there, and there's my brothers and my sister in the backyard. So, wow, we're getting back together. So I get there, I start playing with them. All of a sudden, there's this panic, and they're not supposed to be together. And they literally separated us from each other. We were sitting in the sandbox playing with sand and buckets and stuff like that. So that's the last time I ever saw my brothers or sister. Not the last time I saw my dad. I saw my dad a couple times in foster care. I think I was taken out once to see my mom, and she was living with my grandmother. I'm just remembering as much as I can at this point. Mm-hmm. And that was the last time I saw them.
So I wanted to first express how sorry I am that you put to that. I can't even imagine. And I wanted to maybe transition a little bit to your life as an activist. I mean, you've mentioned that all you've done and how all this pressure has led you to activism, right? Mm-hmm. So can you share a little bit of how was the start of this life for you? And
well, first of all, I take my directions from my elders, and the elders basically said, get yourself arrested, you know, take this to the legal system and see what you can do. And I was actually successful with some of that. So when the first time I got arrested, it seemed like no one else was going to get arrested. And Judy Wilson, one of our elder leaders, she was speaking the one day, and she basically said, "Well, you know, it's time for people to get arrested." So I went, got arrested, and they tried to condemn that. They can't understand the relationship between elders and their and the people. Anyway, I got arrested, and as they were starting to arrest me, I said to them, "Well, you know, the only people that should be arrested are you. I'm talking about the police." I said, "Because I'm sitting on unsurrendered, you know, what do you call it, sovereign territory. And as a sovereign territory, we have the right to say who can be here and who can't. And we've never approved of the pipeline. And none of the other nations, white nations and that around here have approved of the pipeline. And so we're here to tell you to get out, you know, that you can't be here." And I said, "Yeah, if anyone should be arrested, it's you. because you're on our territory imposing yourselves upon us. Anyway, I ended up in court, and I couldn't argue that I shouldn't be convicted because they'd already admitted to the fact that I wanted to be arrested. So that's mens rea. That's me showing them my intent to be mm-hmm. arrested and my knowledge of what I was doing. But then it went from there, and we had no... they gave no consideration, the judge and prosecutors specifically, gave no consideration to the fact that there were rules and laws and everything else that had been passed saying that Indigenous people, they should look for alternatives to sending them to jail. And the judge basically said, well, no, if I have to send non-Indigenous people to jail, then I should have to send Indigenous people to jail, which falls really short, because at that point, we were the first Indigenous people to be sentenced to jail, and there had been a few people with 1 and 2 days, but we had significant, we were 28 days, myself and another fellow called Stacy. And another fellow called Tellum, all three of us were arrested the same day and went through the process together, because we had common claim that we should have. There is an alternate court that they can send you to. There's alternate things to jailhouse, jail sentencing. And this all came out of... there was a thing called the Gladue Report, where a woman named Gladue, the judge took a look at her life and said, well, she's spent her whole life, she hasn't had a chance in life. She spent her whole life, everything she did, she was sentenced to jail. And then they looked at the fact that 70% of the population in some of our provinces are Indigenous. They're the population, Indigenous, the jailhouse population, while less than 7% of the population in those provinces are Indigenous. So it's a great disproportion. So they said, you need to look at other ways. We need to bring in a number of Indigenous people down that are going to jail. She refused to consider it. She refused to transfer our case over to an Indigenous court that would have elders involved in it and determine our sentencing through there. So while I was in jail, I launched an appeal, but I was still in for about 4 or 5 days. And I ended up getting seriously ill. They weren't giving me my medications, and we're actually fighting that right now. So that's the first case. I ended up after jail. I ended up in St. Paul's Hospital with a serious bacterial infection in my body, and they couldn't even put shunts or anything in because they would get infected. And I spent a couple of weeks on breathing tubes and feeding tubes and everything else, and came pretty close to dying. I said to the nurse, I was just going to go home last night instead of coming in here. She said, well, you wouldn't have made it. She said, we barely saved you last night, kind of thing. So with that information, the next time I got sentenced, and she said, I was arrested for another action, but the action took place before my sentencing on the first case. And she was, the judge, Judge Fitzpatrick, said, well, you should have known. I said, well, you obviously didn't read your, the information we gave you, because I was sentenced and did my court time after I was arrested for the second charge. So I had no way of knowing how tough it would be in jail and that I would get sick. And at that point, we introduced the fact that I was sick after I got out. And she still sentenced me to jail anyway. And this time, the exact same thing happened. I went into jail. We also appealed the case, the charges, and we ended up in the second case. So I was sentenced to jail. And I went in and got Again, they didn't give me meds. And I had a massive heart attack while I was in jail and ended up at Eagle Ridge Hospital. And the doctor there said most of the people from that pretrial center are there because they didn't get their meds. So it's a systemic policy that they have. You have to say as well, pretrial is where people go who have not yet been convicted normally. We had been convicted and we were waiting for placement in the right facility. But a lot of the people there haven't even been convicted. So that actually becomes an act of classism, right? That this class of people aren't entitled to them to eagerly follow the need as doctors to give them their meds. And then it becomes racism out of the classism, because we still have 70% of the people, irregardless of what's been said, recommended by the courts or anything else, that are indigenous. Mm-hmm. So there's still, you know, the stuff is still continuing around that. Anyway, we appealed the second sentence, the second conviction. I was doing a pipe ceremony, and I had been doing other stuff. They had a blockade. The other people had a blockade. I was showing some information about the fact that they were shipping contaminated soil out of the tank farm.
Oh my God!
And so we had a blockade there, and I was over beyond the blockade, showing to the media what was going on. Then I waited for all the media to be gone and everything to settle down. And I went over to end the blockade with a pipe ceremony. And the police were involved in the pipe ceremony with us. And nothing happened. I said to them, well, okay, we're going to finish the pipe ceremony. It's only going to take about 20 more minutes. And then we're going to go. And we finished the pipe ceremony. And we left. And that was the 2nd of December. On the 20th of December, my lawyer calls me and said, what'd you do? I said, what are you talking about? He says, well, they just issued a warrant for your arrest. I said, what? And I had to think about it. I said, hang on, I haven't done anything since the 2nd of December. And he looked and said, yeah, that's what the warrant's for. And so anyway, we appealed the case, and they found that the prosecution was wrong, that the judge was wrong, and that I was in fact holding a ceremony for the mens rea, what I talked about before, the intent to show contempt for the government was not there. My intent was to hold a pipe ceremony at the instruction of my elders. So I was to hold a pipe ceremony to end the blockade and to end it peacefully, and that's what I was doing. So they actually found in my favor, and they also found that in the process that nothing was considered around Gladue, nothing was considered around recommendations from the prosecution service that Indigenous people not go to jail. And then they said that in fact the judge had far overstepped her rights, because what a judge has to do is take what's put in front of her and consider it. And what they found her doing was digging deeper to justify the prosecution. So she's not sitting in a neutral place. She's sitting in a biased place where she's... So anyway, they ordered that that case be canceled and that they could try me again, which so that's without prejudice, right?
Mm-hmm.
When we came to court, they turned around the attorney general's deputy attorney general was in there, and I don't know what he said, but all I know for sure is that the prosecutor said, we've taken a look at it and that we have no hope that this case would come out any differently, that we would have the same result, because they had given me permission to do different things that they were now punishing me for doing, right? It's like holding pipe ceremonies and holding them on the road and stuff. So that was that. But where we're at right now, and I guess one of the things I've learned as an activist is it isn't necessarily what's right in front of your face that you're dealing with. It can be other things. And that's what happened here. So we are now going to, we went last year, we're going again. In the last case, we're going in this one. We're going to the,